Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Friday, March 27th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We have a fascinating day ahead of us, you and I, and we're going to first start off the opening segment with none other than Victoria Garrity. She's the mayor of Ossining. And at 10:30, we're going to be joined by none other than Mount Vernon Mayor Sean Patterson Howard. And we're going to discuss many issues. Probably the most important is how they can continue to govern with a new layer of complexity that was heretofore unknown. And so that's what we're going to find out and talk about. Let's bring in our first caller. It's none other than Mayor Victoria Garrity. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Hezzy. How are you doing today? How are you holding up under these very unusual circumstances?
Well, the nice thing is that I don't have any children at home, and I live alone now, I'm widowed. So the thing is, I'm looking at the walls, and they're stable. And I'm not going into a state of frenzy or some crazy thing, and it's working. And I have enough food at home. I planned for it last week. I figured it's going to come, and it's working out fine. And what about you? You have much more people in your home, so it's got to be a bit more claustrophobic.
I have many more people in my home all the time now. I usually get to work from home a lot, and I enjoy working from home.
Right.
But that my children are gone 7 or 8 hours a day, and my husband is gone many, many hours a day because he usually has a full-time job. I think you know he works
right.
in film and television for his paid gig, but then he works at the brewery when he gets home from that. So I'm usually, you know, at best I have two children home, but usually I spend a lot of time by myself. And now I'm at least a couple of other people, although because breweries are on the list of essential services, my husband is still going to work.
Right.
And like so many other restaurants and bars is doing takeout and delivery. So and trying to figure out how to keep their doors from shuttering, which is obviously
yeah.
And I was pleased to see that I think there's actually a lot of good news on the state level and the county level that this is actually working to slow the spread and to flatten the curve, that the increases of infection are slowing down. And so that's good news. And it makes it feel
well,
like
I didn't even realize that. I didn't realize they were slowing down. Okay,
yeah,
great.
But the good news is we have slowed the rate of infection in Westchester. And
uh-huh.
that is very good news because it is certainly an imposition on all of our lives. Children are learning from computers, hopefully sort of learning, certainly not the way we normally do. Mm-hmm. And this could continue for a little bit more time. So it's good to know that it's working. And Westchester is, we're a model for the rest of the country. In fact, I was just on Facebook with some of my family from Massachusetts yesterday, where they're not at the
mm-hmm.
same stage that we are. And they're still in the stage of one uncle was suggesting, and I have two very conservative uncles that live in
yeah.
in Massachusetts. We never agree politically. But in this case, me and my most conservative uncle ganged up on my other uncle who suggested it should just be by choice. Whoever wants to self-isolate, isolates. And we explained to him all the reasons why, though that would be really nice because it really is a major imposition. You can't do that. And so it was it's good to see that sometimes the recognition for the need to do the social distancing and have these really extreme measures transcends political ideology. So it can work, although we certainly have politicized a lot of this conversation that I don't think at another time in history would have been the case. But sometimes I wouldn't even call it common sense because this is not logical based on any of our past experience to say, hey, we have a crisis. Everybody, that's not human nature. It's really not human nature.
It's not.
But we are figuring it out. And thankfully, it's happening in a moment when we have the technology to be able to stay connected, to keep some things operational. I think I'll go back to your original question is how the heck do we function as a local government where all of our facilities are closed to the public, and we need to still be able to engage with the public. And so Wednesday evening, I chaired the first public village board meeting via Zoom. It went pretty well.
Yes.
We had the benefit
Great.
Of it being a work session. So In work sessions, if there's not there's not a public hearing involvement, there's not a public comment aspect of it. It's the village elected officials, staff, and invited guests. And so we had as many as 10 people on the screen at some times, and we got through a very weighty agenda. We had a lot of things that were discussed, and you know, there's actually some advantages to it. Not only do I get to do it from the privacy of my own home. So as soon as I turn off the computer, I just walk out and I get to spend the rest of the night, you know, chatting with my husband right away. It's not right. Just that, which is a little bit more convenient, not what I'd wish for, but you know, you gotta find the silver linings and everything, right? We all really got it was good to know that the business of the village can continue to move forward. One of the things we talked about, which seems so much less weighty considering we're talking about life and death and how to manage that most of the day, mm-hmm. but was how do we have events in more effectively and more consistently and in a way that makes the best usage of public resources, and so creating new event publications. And so that was like sort of a really ordinary municipal function that we were able to discuss at length on Wednesday evening by Zoom. You know, so that's an example of the business of the village is still moving forward. I will say for a few days it was tough to move to think about anything other than what's the next evolution of the next restriction and what does that mean and what are we hearing from the governor and what are we hearing from the county executive. But we're finding a little bit of a balance now that we're all sort of isolated in wherever we're going to be. And any of us who can work virtually are. But obviously in village government, in any municipal government, there are a lot of people that have to report to work every day to keep us safe, to keep yes. the community operational, and mm-hmm. they're doing it. And we're so, so grateful for them. So far, we have not cut back on any of the services that we provide. Obviously, the parks are a little differently utilized than they were because normally parks are a wonderful gathering space. And this is right. one of the things that's been a challenge in, I know you're speaking with the mayor of Mount Vernon later, and so she would have a similar mm-hmm. challenge in her community. And it's similar to New York City parks. And I understand New York City parks, the playgrounds are still open. Our playgrounds are shut down. Mm. And that's because it's some place that, you know, it children can't avoid touching with their hands and then, you know,
right.
putting their hands in their face and stuff. So it would just be a hotbed for infection. And I, you know, my heart goes out to the people in the city because it's millions of people in a similar situation to what thousands of people in our community face, which is there are many people living in small homes and no yard. And for this to be sustainable yes. for weeks and months at a time, it's unreasonable to say that we're going to shut down the parks completely. However, we have greatly curtailed their usage. Where people used to gather and play soccer, they're now being told there's no group sports, there's no group activities. Mm-hmm. It's all individual. Take a walk, take a run, walk your dog, ride your bike. The only people that you should be within 6 feet of are people who are in your household. And I will say, Hezzy, I have lived alone in my life, although it's been a number of years. It would be mm-hmm. tough to be completely alone. You live in your home alone. My brother lives alone in an apartment in Brooklyn. And mm-hmm. you know, there's nice things, a lot of nice things about living alone, but to be, unable to escape that once in a while must be especially difficult. I have to say I'm pretty grateful that my kids are still around, that they're not they haven't moved right. out yet. Yeah.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
our schools,
it's a very,
course,
very difficult time.
It is. Hey, Hezzy, what have you heard about the elections or the New York State budget? Because it's been a couple of days since I've spoken with anybody or been focused on what's happening in Albany. It sounded like there might be some consolidation of election days and expansion of absentee ballot access.
I think so. I think the real problem is that the coronavirus seems to have literally sucked the wind and the political drive to complete the responsibility of the state government, and that is to work out a budget. Normally, you expect the budget to be completed by the 1st of April, which is like it's a number. Which mm-hmm. the government always wants to adhere to as close as possible. So they always prefer to have it in by the 1st. If it happens a few days later or even a week or two later, it's not the end of the world. However, it's going to put even a greater financial strain. on communities all over the state, including, of course, Westchester County and individual cities and towns and villages, because we don't know how it'll be parceled out financially. You know, there's aid to municipalities and how much is going to come down the pike, how much for education, and so on and so forth, at a time when we're being stressed to an unbelievable degree financially. So
absolutely,
I think that is yes. the biggest problem. And yet, I know from a local level, and this is not to admonish any particular government, so I'm not going to mention, but the bottom line is that so many of the governments are practically shut down. There isn't always as much communication as one would hope. I think you're on the cutting edge using Zoom. There are other communities where the city councils have stopped operating and they don't utilize Zoom. They don't have discussions that is private, where you have meetings with the city council members and they discuss different committees, you know, whether it be real estate or something else, and they just don't go there. So a lot of it has been put on hold. You've eclipsed that crisis to the best of your ability. And not everyone's been doing that. That's what's so celebratory about talking to you, because you seem to have a conceptualization of how it should be, what the norm is, and also how to contend with the challenges at a particular time. And that goes to your leadership. And that's wanting in some of the communities in Westchester County and not for others. So,
thank you for the pat on the back. Thank you for the pat on the back.
Yeah, but it's appropriate. It's appropriate. You know it is. At least I know it is. It doesn't matter what you think. Not that I don't take whatever you say seriously, but I know in this particular case, I'm right. It's about the only thing I'm right about.
Well, I know that other mayors and municipal governments are finding some ways, and I have not done a tally on all 40 some odd of us in Westchester, but I have seen Mayor Patterson is regularly doing Facebook Lives. I've seen Mayor Rainey doing some Facebook Live announcements.
Yes.
And I know that we were not the first to do a Zoom meeting. The town did theirs the night before, and we're all figuring that out. What's the best way to make it accessible? And I think we're going to do an even better job next week as we. And it's a challenge. I will say, fortunately, and now that I'm in my third term as mayor, and it's my last term as mayor, and I look back and I say,
I cry about that every night.
Well, I don't know. If I had known that I'd be spending a good part of my last year doing this stuff and not being able to move forward big projects, I might not. I might have taken that into consideration. But I look back at the things that I feel really good about, and one of them is communication. And that was one of my key priorities when I came in. And one of the reasons why I was able to set a higher expectation for communication is because there are so many things that as an individual mayor I could do. I could say I will be there every Tuesday until now, of course. I will be there every Tuesday in my office. If you are able to come and see me in person, come see me in person. That doesn't work.
Right.
Then soon after that, I started sending out an email and saying, look, I want everybody to know this is what's happening in village government, and this is how you can get in touch with us. Right. And we started having much more communication. We got a new website. We started with the constant contact communication, which is just far superior to any emails we used to send. So by setting that as a standard that we need to up our game and improve our communication with the public, we saw that we've had now set a new expectation for how people will communicate. And even when I'm not mayor again, I know that my successor is already figuring out how she can keep that same level of communication with the public in a way that works for her life, because she has a regular job, so she can't be there Tuesdays at 10 a.m. And that's fine, but she's an empty nester, so she doesn't, you know, feel the need to spend her Saturdays on soccer field with her family. So maybe she can do something on a Saturday to be accessible to people, and that'll be accessible to a whole new group of people. And I'm so proud that there is now communication of what communication is appropriate. And now that communication can't be face-to-face, we've been able to transition as much as possible in an evolving way to mm-hmm. using social media, to using the online platforms, and everybody is. I did a practice before our Wednesday meeting. I had a group of friends practice with me so I could practice hosting a Zoom meeting, and that was so fun to have, you know, 10 of my buddies just getting together and being able to connect with each other virtually and see each other. And that was a really special thing. And I'm figuring out I'm going to do a personal Zoom account because my son is turning 12 next week. His birthday is April 1st, which apparently is also Census Day and is also our budget day, due date for Albany and April Fool's Day and my little guy's birthday. And of course, this is not like any other birthday year for him. So I'm hoping I can get all the grandparents to figure out how to log on to a Zoom birthday celebration. He doesn't know that yet. So keep that secret with you, Hezzy.
Okay. Won't mention it. But no, that's great.
And I will say also, I'm very impressed with how much access we have to George Latimer. I don't know when that man sleeps. I know that I spoke with his director of communication this weekend. You know, she lives in the Austin community, and I actually, Catherine Chaffee, and she has young children. In fact, the last week of school that we had before everything was shut down, I was a mystery reader, and I went to a third grade classroom at our Claremont school, and it just so happens that Catherine Chaffee's son was in that class, and so she and I had been in communication recently. And then I performed a wedding for a friend of hers last weekend. We are still doing weddings. Nice. That was on the list. Essential services. So in this case, there was a reason why the family that needed to have the wedding. You know, there's all kinds of people time things for big events for good reason. And so I actually went and performed the wedding. It was a beautiful day down at the Hudson River. And so I got a chance to chat with Chiaffi, with Catherine Chiaffi, you know, from standing 8 feet away from each other. And she was saying that George Latimer, you know, he's so accustomed to just driving all over the county all the time and being with people. And she's had to rein him in and do, I don't know if you've watched any of his recent press briefings, but it's basically to an empty room. Everybody's connecting virtually, just him and a few staff members that are actually in the building. And so we're all figuring out how to do this. But he called into our meeting on Wednesday night and gave us the update from the county's, you know, their concerns, their updates on everything that's going on and what is open and what isn't open and why and what we can anticipate. And I do feel like we've gotten to a little bit of, to say stability is kind of silly because it's such a weird time that we're in. But the first week, everything was changing all the time. Like, what does the state of emergency mean? When will the schools close? How long the school can they close? And what should we close the parks? And what does that mean? And how do we communicate that? And so there's a little bit of scrambling for that first week. And I think there's less scrambling and there's more, okay, is this working? And we have evidence that it is working. And so, of course, now everybody wants to know what's next. But I will say I'm pleased to see that the governor's tone has shifted, seems less while some of his counterparts in other states are suggesting that nobody will go back to school until September, he's definitely not saying that yet. And he's also trying to figure out, will we get to a point where some people have had the virus and have recovered and have the immunity? And if they're no longer a risk, is there a way for people to be out back out in the world? And we know that they're not creating a problem and they can actually help get us to a new level of functionality. So I'll be interested to see how this unfolds in the next couple of weeks. It's really a fascinating time to be alive. I mean, horrible in so many ways because of the health risk and the economic devastation that I know we're going to be facing. But, if somebody has to live through it, I'm kind of glad that I'm alive to be here. I'm kind of glad that I'm the mayor in this moment to see from the inside how a government and how all of our governments are handling it and how the people of our community are handling it. And crisis brings out both the best and the worst in people. You have to be super careful opening emails today because there's, you know, horrible people who are taking advantage of, any crisis situation. But for the most part, people are trying to figure out how in this world of social distancing, how can they help their neighbors? So, for example, there is a woman in Ossining who decided she wanted to help connect people just by phone, people who are lonely and want to be able to talk to someone, not necessarily because they are asking for help, just because, gosh, it by yourself for hours and hours at a time.
Right.
And so So just if people are interested in connecting, we put out in our communications yesterday, there's a flyer with information that people can reach out to and they can send an email or they can reach out by phone and say, look, I'd really like to just be able to talk to someone, just to have another human mm-hmm. contact because I've lost my normal connections. And that's something right. that people can do. People who are trapped in their homes, they're being creative and innovative and thoughtful and wanting to, you know, help out their neighbors in whatever way they're capable. So it's really in that way, it is an inspiring time to be alive. I was in New York City for 9/11, and I remember feeling that same mm-hmm. sense of despair and yet, a sense of inspiration and be feeling heartened by the human spirit and desire to connect.
Yeah, it's a very big challenge. I can't imagine that when you thought of becoming a mayor, you're going to run for political office, this was in your cards. But what's the takeaway for you at the moment? Because you're living through this crisis now. Are you a futurist? Can you predict or can you contemplate what might happen now that we may get used to this whole concept of working electronically and through video and teleconferencing and stuff like that? Are more people going to be working at home? Are we going to need offices like we used to have? Are overseers, like the boss, so to speak, are they going to need to see you at the office in order to make sure that you're working your 8-hour day? Or are we going to be able to evolve in a different way now? Because I think a lot's going to have to change.
Yeah. I think you're right, Hezzy. I think there's going to be – I wouldn't want to be somebody who owns a lot of office space right now because I don't think that's going to be a hot
Absolutely
commodity
not.
Going forward. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think you're right. I wish that I'd bought Zoom stock a month ago because I'd be a rich lady right now.
Yep.
And I think there's definitely going to be a shift in how we work. There's definitely going to be, unfortunately, some loss of businesses. A lot of small businesses are struggling right now,
yeah.
and they're mm-hmm. they're not going to make it. I think there's going to be some places that have the shared workspace, the co-working spaces. Those we might see those become more prevalent, and that might be a nice way for people to be able to connect. I think we are missing the in-person
mm-hmm.
connection. I think there'll be a combination of both people recognizing that we don't need to have the same old stagnant shared workspace in the form that we once
mm-hmm.
had, but I think people will also realize the limitations of this. And that we do need to be, there are some things that you cannot get from a Zoom meeting. There are some communications,
right.
there are some projects that you cannot move forward as effectively with virtual communications. So I think there's going to be a reshuffling of things. I'm very concerned about what's going to happen to our economy. I look at the village of Ossining, and we're just, tens of thousands of people,
mm-hmm.
but more than half of the kids in our school district are on free and reduced lunch. Most of those families struggling to make ends meet on a good day. And so many of them just do not have an income now, because the only people who are able to maintain their level of income are people who are either a union laborer and they have a really great contract, or they're able to work remotely.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are able to work remotely are typically not the folks who are working in the service industry, the people who are filling all of these businesses that are either closed or severely curtailed. While we are addressing food insecurity in Ossining, we were the first to start partnering with Feeding Westchester to have a mobile food kitchen. The school district has grab-and-go breakfast and lunch 5 days a week. So we really are proactively addressing the food insecurity challenges for the families in our neighbor
mm-hmm.
community who need it, so that whatever money they do have, they can use to pay elsewhere. But I am deeply concerned about the financial stability for families and small businesses in our communities going forward. In the short term, though they're not going to be evicted right now, unless landlords have the ability to forgive rent, what happens when the
mm-hmm.
courts open back up? I mean, then people have just a bunch of back rent to pay that they couldn't. It's not like they've been saving up money looking forward to paying double rent going forward.
Right.
So it's going to be very, very difficult to to reestablish the financial relationship people have had to be able to have their living space or their small business space. So, I, and unfortunately, the government revenues are so deeply deeply cut. It's difficult to say to Albany, use all of your money to bail us out. We need some forgiveness. We need some of our bills that you would have been expecting us to pay, whether that's for businesses, their sales tax. Their sales tax, they've given the ability for sales tax, quarterly sales tax for local businesses to be paid late without a fee, or without any late fees. However, it's not like if people just don't have the money to pay it right now. They're not going to have the money to pay it after they've been basically shut for however long it takes for this to end. So not having to pay a fee is nice, but they still have to pay the bill. So they pay that bill. So what does that mean? Does that mean they hire less staff and fewer people that are getting back into the workforce when the doors open back up? So those are sort of the micro aspects of it. Like more macro, the money in our economy is someplace. It's either on paper with corporate investments, or it's in the hands of the people who are still earning money. So I was does Shelley Mayer represent you in Albany?
Yes, she does. Because
She is just always so at the forefront of progressive conversation, and she is such a fighter for education funding. And we are so grateful for her in Austin, I'm sure, because she represents Yonkers. She's aware of the impacts and the absolute necessity we have for state funding for education. And she, from what I've read, and I know she read my comments on social media, I was just so grateful that she was fighting for the millionaire's tax to go through this year. And to me, you've got to tax the people that have the money. And the village government, our budget isn't due till the end of the year, but our school budget, they're figuring that out right now. We pass the school budget immediately after the state passes their budget. And I really, really hope, I understand that in Albany, from conversations I've had with some legislators and their staff, that it's possible they'll pass a budget by April 1st, but then they'll do a supplemental a few months later when they have a better picture of the financial standing.
See.
That's too late for our school districts to figure out what they need. So I'm still optimistic that they will, that Cuomo, though it's not what he doesn't like passing additional taxes, but he's got to raise the millionaire's tax. He's got to create that. And I know that the assembly had to put that in their original proposal. If it could make it through, now is the time. If it's ever going to happen, now is the time, and it's necessary.
Do you think, though, from on the macro level, will the federal government, as they haven't yet approved, and we still need to get congressional approval in both houses, and then the president has to sign that $2 trillion infusion into the market, will that be able to suffice? Are we going to engage everybody?
I have a lot less faith in the federal government being able to pass something that will truly be helpful to the people who need it than I do in our entirely democratically led New York State government. We are the first state to really see the impacts of coronavirus. We are one of the only states to have a Democrat as governor and in both houses of the legislature. I think we need to be the leaders on this. We're leading the way and showing people how to flatten the curve. We need to lead the way in showing people how to handle the financial implications. And that's what I keep telling to anybody who works in Albany, and I hope that they take it to heart. I think this is I wouldn't say it's an opportunity for us to be leaders. It's more it's incumbent upon us. It's absolutely necessary for our state to be the leader for the country. We're demonstrating how to do it right here in Westchester County in a behavioral way. Financially, we need the state to step up.
Well, I think that's really interesting because the coronavirus has really pushed people or cajoled people to leadership roles that they may not have ever thought would be in their future. But the governor is amazing. Extemporaneously, he's able to put thoughts and concepts together without looking at a piece of paper, and he remembers it all. I don't think I could do that anymore. Maybe when I was 50, but I don't know if I could do that today. He's just so good at what he does, and the fact that he can go from serious to glib and throw in a brogue in the meantime, and when asked a question, and also talk about his life as well. It makes it very, very personable. I don't think I've seen that from anyone else in a very, very long time. But it's effective.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's doing a terrific job as a leader. He's very reassuring in his level of understanding, his level of confidence, and he's really the right leader for the moment, I would say. He's a very strong personality, and he takes it so seriously, and it is really, really stepping up as the voice and the leader that we need to be able to see each day. And unfortunately, that should be coming from the president, and it's not. But at least we have it here in New York State, and for that reason, it's a good thing that this virus started in our state, because we have a strong governor to be able to demonstrate how to handle it.
Exactly, because our governor did a lot better than the state of Washington, which was, I think, the first place that there was incidences. But they didn't know really how to manage it. Well, Mayor, as usual, it's always invigorating to talk to you. I wish you well and
thank you.
And health and just security in that way. And good luck with what you're doing, because it's a lot of fun. Oh, I forgot to tell you, you know that Echo bags? You know, I was looking to get my crocheted bag so I don't have to carry plastic and stuff. I ordered them from all different kinds of colors, which was really terrific. And then I knew I would need that many, but I handed two of them because I ordered five. But I gave two of them to my neighbors, and they just love it. So I think they're going to order more. It's really great stuff.
From EcoBag.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
Which is created by my neighbor here in Austin, just a half a mile away from me.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, EcoBag is created by Sharon Rowe. She's an Austin resident, and she started it a number of years ago before the, and her goal was always to get as many plastic bags out of the world as possible. And we've had her as a panelist on the Odd series early on, talking about the impact of plastic bags. Mm-hmm. So now it's an interesting new world. It's great to see her people taking to heart that mission in such a big way.
You know, you needed options, and I remember living that way when I was much younger, but that goes back many, many years. It goes back 50 years when I used to have that sort of a bag, and it worked out great, but then I don't know what happened. I guess plastics came into the world, and that became more convenient, supposedly. Who knows? Anyway, it's a challenging world. Well, all the best, Mayor. I'm looking
always
forward
a pleasure,
to
the
more months in the future. Be well. All the best
looking
to your family.
To
and happy
Bye-bye.
Birthday to your son. Take care.
Thank
Bye.
You, Hezzy. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. None other than Mayor Garrity, Victoria Garrity. Her weekly discourse with the public in her articles are just fantastic. Always a worthwhile read. And it tells you really what's going on in the community of Austin, which is very exciting, very, very exciting indeed. Well, we eventually will have Mayor Sean Patterson Howard from Mount Vernon will join us, and we'll be able to talk to her about a lot of issues that impact the city. So besides the coronavirus, they're challenged by a lot of other things. First, a lot of the deleterious conduct of past administration under Thomas, the bridging moments when you had the acting mayor, then eventually the mayor, Andre Wallace, that lasted for about 3 months. And then, of course, with Mayor Sean Patterson Howard, once elected, now in office. She's in office now, January, February, March, it's almost the end of March, so 3 months. And yet the same things that choked the capacity of Mount Vernon government continues to this day, not because of the mayor, but because of other actors and actresses in the political, construct of the city of Mount Vernon. So there are challenges that way that still impact this particular administration. In one interesting way, there was a great deal of concern even before the mayor took office, and Andre Wiles was still the mayor, there was a notification that they would close that Mount Montefiore Hospital that owned the Mount Vernon Hospital was going to shut it down. And they were going to create another place where it was more like an urgent center, an urgent care facility rather than a hospital setting. I think there are 150 beds in Mount Vernon Hospital. And in a sense, one of the good things about the coronavirus is that it is now become important and pertinent to maintain the doors of Mount Vernon Hospital open, at least for the foreseeable future. I don't know how long that'll be. It could be a month, could be 3 months, could be 6 months, could be a year. I'm not quite sure how long that would be. But whatever the case is, it seems prudent for Montefiore to consider keeping the place open. The beds are necessary. We know it's necessary because as Mayor Garrity was talking about before, George Latimer, the county executive, he's all over the place. And one of the things that he's decided to do is they're going to convert the Westchester County Center and make that a hospital setting. And so they're going to convert that. Then there are other places that are being converted for use. An ice skating rink, in not here in Westchester County that I remember, but in one place somewhere in the New York metropolitan area, was used as a morgue. People are dying still, maybe unrelated, of course, not always related to the coronavirus, but for other reasons. People get old. People have different diseases that that force them to succumb. And despite everything that they try to do from a medical perspective. So there are so many things that are changing, so many demands, new demands. In fact, we need so much hospital space that the New York State delegation had beseeched the president in order to send the U.S. Navy ship, for the ambulance. I know what they call it. It's a floating ambulance, really. And I don't know how many beds they have, but they're going to actually take anchor in New York Harbor on the East Coast, and there's another ship that will be in the Pacific, probably in California, but that would also give them up to move from place to place, I guess, if necessary. And also, as you get more the largest center of people succumbing to the coronavirus happens to be New York City. And that being the case, so it seems logical to bring it here, the naval ship here. However, at the same time, as more structures are built to accommodate people in a hospital setting with ventilators and whatever else that's necessary, and hopefully, actually, you never know how quickly a vaccine will come about, because everyone in the world is struggling to put together a vaccine that is actually appropriate and will function well without deleterious, and injurious aspects to it, to the patients that take it. And there's a lot of other issues as well. Will this be a future event? The common flu returns every year. Ebola hasn't been wiped out, not because it couldn't be wiped out. It's because there is fighting Congo, Uganda, that whole area. They're still fighting, and the fight seems to be more important than saving lives. So instead of inoculating people and making sure that they overcome the Ebola virus, the fight keeps going and people are not getting their medication and to fight it off. So that has not been killed. But then you've had other things like the swine flu. They put an end to that. The chicken flu, there was flu that was killing chickens and also ducks. And that they've been able to eradicate, and then there are other things as well. And this coronavirus, my only question is there only one strain? Because this is very, very interesting, which has not been really spoken about. But it seems that there were some people from China who had left China before the first case of the coronavirus was ever, assuming that the information is correct from China with regard to it. They say the number one person that first showed symptoms of the coronavirus was someone that they recognized on November 17th of last year. Now, were abroad at that time, way before November 17th, who were attending businesses, so they were working abroad, whether it be in Europe or Africa or other parts of Asia or in North and or South America, and or some people had gone for studies. And then now that it seems that the coronavirus has been mitigated in China to some extent, or to a great extent as far as the government is saying, what was interesting is that those people that returned from either a business engagement for many months and came back to China only recently, maybe in the last 2 weeks, and or came to visit family because they hadn't been able to visit them because of the coronavirus, you know, putting a ban on travel. Airplanes are not flying. Many people were stranded all over the world. I know there were people stranded in Peru and in Brazil and so many other places because the planes just stopped flying. So the bottom line is that when all this happened, when these people who were Chinese and were doing something else abroad, when they came back to China about 2 weeks ago, they were infecting people in China. So it was communicated from those people who may have had the were asymptomatic in the United States or Europe or wherever, and when they came to China, they didn't realize that they would be infecting other people. The big question is, are the people that are being infected now by the people who came in from abroad of Chinese ethnicity, were they carrying a virus that had permutated from its original where it was found first, which is in China? So did the virus change when it left China and infected other parts of the world? And then when other people of Chinese ancestry who happened to be going to school or engaged in a job abroad were in touch with people who evidently infected them? And they were never infected in China. They were infected in maybe in the United States. Maybe it was in Washington State, or maybe it was in New York, or maybe it was on a business trip to Washington, D.C., where they've been working for 6 months or a year, whatever. So when some of these people came back to China, they were starting to infect people that had, we're not sure if they had overcome the virus initially in China, or if they had never had experienced this virus at all. So it was completely new to them, but they were never infected by people within China. And now this virus is coming back to China through these emissaries that, in a sense, didn't realize that they were infected and they're infecting a new group of people. So is this going to continue like this? Nothing to be scared about. But certainly something to be considered, because it doesn't explain why these viruses are now taking hold again. They had for 2 or 3 days in China, they had absolutely no cases whatsoever, and all of a sudden it started. It started with one or two. Before you knew it, it was already at 50, and that was maybe 3 or 4 or 5 days ago. I'm not exactly sure, because I didn't keep up with that. There was so much stuff here locally, there was just no time to focus in on that sort of stuff. So that was very, very important, and it's really an important issue. And you know what? While I'm doing that, we're waiting for the mayor. I might as well play a commercial for you. Bear with me a moment. I have to get that. One second. Let me just see where that is. One second. Let me see if I have it. Oh, here it is. Yeah, let me read this to you. This is a message from District Attorney Anthony Scarpino. So he writes there's a commercial. So District Attorney Tony Scarpino wants you to know that during this time of uncertainty, with so many of us at home and many businesses closed, that the criminal justice system is open and remains active to serve you. As always, he says, call 911 to report all crimes. In addition, if you or someone you know has been the victim of domestic violence, child abuse, or elder abuse, call District Attorney Scarpino's Special Prosecution's Office. That number is 914-995-3000. Again, the District Attorney Scarpino's Special Prosecution's Office can be reached at 914-995-3000. District Attorney Scarpino wants you to know that despite the coronavirus, the criminal justice system will always be here for you, and he urges you to stay at home and stay safe. Very, very pertinent message due to him for making it. And so let me just quickly look. I want to be able to look at this video screen and at the same time also catch up with some news for you as best I can. Now, this is very interesting as well. It seems that the jobless claims have surged to 3.3 million, which is a record in the United States. It's the first picture of the coronavirus damage, and the weekly totals dwarf the 1.7 million that was expected. It seems that more than 3 million Americans filed a claim for unemployment benefits last week, a record high that offers the first nationwide picture of the damage to the U.S. economy from the coronavirus shutdown. According to data released by the Labor Department yesterday, claims rose to $3.3 million for the week ending on Saturday from $282,000 the previous week. So the data eclipsed consensus expectations of 1.7 million, showing the staggering scale of job losses in the first full week of claims since cities and states began to restrict public gatherings and, in some cases, order residents to stay home. Nearby, every state providing comments cited the COVID-19 virus impacts, Hartman had said. Hotels and restaurants had been particularly hard hit, states said, as well as entertainment, transportation, manufacturing, healthcare, and social assistance. It's just disastrous on so many levels, said Torsten Slok. He's the chief economist at Deutsche Bank Securities, and that companies are already having serious consequences and both for growth and for the labor market, he added. It is by far the largest single week rise in unemployment claims since the department began publishing records in 1967. The previous 1 week high came in October of 1982 at 695,000 and March 2009 at 665,000. Well, this is an impossible to comprehend number. We just wiped out a year and a half of job growth, said Martha Gimbel, an economist at Schmidt Futures. The most important thing to remember is that this is an undercount of people suffering. The claims data only reflect people able to apply for an unemployment insurance benefit. Others may not qualify, had hours cut, or could not get into state systems when labor agency websites crashed, and that was a big issue. Even people who thought they filled out the forms, it did not take. Economists at Oxford Economics had predicted 15 to 20 million jobs losses in coming weeks. The U.S. unemployment rate had been at 3.5% prior to the outbreak, a half century low And Mr. Slack said this week's job losses alone could add 2 percentage points. My God. So in an interview with NBC yesterday, Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said the U.S., quote, may well, end quote, be in recession already. Mohamed El-Erian, the chief economic advisor at Allianz, said that the jobs data highlighted, quote, the ferocity of the sudden stop hitting the U.S. economy. We're living through a generation-defining moment, he added. So very, very compelling and very important. Give you some highlights because hopefully by then the mayor will call. China bans foreigners over virus fears. Beijing has said it will temporarily suspend visits from almost all foreigners amid fears those returning after the country eased its travel curbs were sparking a second wave of virus cases. This is what I was just talking to you about. Volkswagen urges the European Central Bank to buy commercial paper. The biggest car maker told the Financial Times that the central bank should send clear signals, quote unquote, and buy the paper, short-term debt that often matures in as little as 6 or 9 months as soon as possible. Time law, an act under which he can compel the manufacture of certain goods, has taken center stage as critics accuse Donald Trump of not doing enough in the virus fight. Wallenberg warns of a lost generation. Swedish industrialist Jacob Wallenberg has warned that governments risk depression and social unrest unless they weigh the economic threat of the virus more heavily. This is something that we spoke about on radio this Wednesday when we spoke to Dr. Oren M. Levin-Wolfman. You might want to just listen into that broadcast. Pensioners to fund the Putin package. It seems that measures introduced by the Russian president to soften the economic blow of the coronavirus pandemic will be partly funded by a levy on bank deposits tapping middle-class nest eggs. Well, Catalonia and Madrid are clashing over curbs. A big surge of coronavirus cases in Catalonia has increased tensions between the northeastern region and the Spanish government, which is now being pushed to shut down almost the entire economy. Now, orange juice pips other commodities. Frozen concentrated orange juice traded in New York has been the best performing commodity this year, according to Bloomberg data. Rising 25% to $1.214 since January. So that's about $1.75. So, and I saw that at the supermarket about a week ago. I was surprised. They were charging seemingly $2 more than normal. Bear with me 1 second here because I'm looking at the paper. Well, I'm looking at the paper here. I did take some notes, but I'm just, I can't look at the studio screen while I'm reading some of my work in order to serve you with that. But I'm just going to look at this one thing here and... One second. I wanted to look to see where I could find this. All right, I don't see this here. So maybe I just thought it was in here and it's not here. I looked at it before. Maybe I was looking at something else. Oh, yeah, this is what it was. So I did find it. Okay, this comes from the Financial Times. This is their article. It says a vaccine is at least 18 months away, that's what the scientists believe. And bear with me a second. Sorry for all that noise. But pharmaceutical groups are now adapting existing treatments to help slow the outbreak amid intense political scrutiny of their work. Well, I didn't read this before, so we'll go over this very quickly. It is just 14 days since doctors at Northwell Health, the largest healthcare provider in New York City, decided to take the search for a coronavirus drug into their own hands. And many of their COVID-19 patients were not getting better, and some were getting worse. Two of the hospital scientists called their contacts at U.S. biotech companies Gilead and Regeneron to offer to test their potential treatments, an antiviral called Remdesivir and an anti-inflammatory called Kevzara, developed for Ebola and rheumatoid arthritis, respectively. Now, clinicians, researchers, and regulators scrambled to set up the clinical trials, which usually take months, and four days later, two patients took their first dose of the experimental drugs. The patients were very, very sick, says Kevin Tracy, president of the Feinstein Institute, the research arm of Northwell Health. After 30 years of doing research, it was one of the proudest days of my life to know patients were getting treated with these drugs that may help them. The hospital hopes the drugs will stop the replication of the virus and reduce inflammation in the lungs. As the global pandemic spreads, recorded cases have more than doubled over the past week to almost 500,000, with more than 22,000 deaths. No one can afford to wait the 18 months it might take to find a vaccine, and Northwell is one of many hospitals across the globe running clinical trials on drugs that were developed for other diseases, from Ebola to malaria to arthritis, but which early studies suggest could offer some hope to COVID patients. Now, doctors are desperate for evidence of what works. In the next month, they will learn more as some key trials in China are due to publish preliminary results. Yet the desire from politicians and investors for a miracle cure has led to a maelstrom of misinformation about drugs for the virus. Just as Northwell was dosing its first patients, President Donald Trump said the Food and Drug Administration had approved the anti-malarials chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine for use against COVID-19. And this turned out to be wrong, with fatal consequences. The FDA is just collecting evidences on whether they work. It's very interesting. There's a fine line with regard to these two drugs, chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. There is such a fine line between overdosing and having the appropriate amount of use. I think it's also used for people who have lupus. Well, anyway, Christos Kyriatsos, the vice president of research and infectious diseases at Regeneron, that's here in Westchester County, says that anecdotal evidence from China is a reason to be optimistic that Kevzara, developed with Sanofi, which is a French company that also makes chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, will help COVID-19 patients suffering from acute respiratory distress syndrome. So, the challenge now is finding the best and quickest way to see if it is effective in the clinic, he adds. That's very, very important, because if you can get meaningful data, and if the data is positive, we can expand access to something like this, which is going to be life-saving. And then there's the drug options. Scientists are investigating three main types of drugs. The first are antivirals to stop the virus from replicating. Treatment guidelines compiled by the Chinese government during the outbreak include HIV drug combination Keletra, which U.S. biotech ABBVIE recently waived its patents on, so it can be made available as a generic. Antimalarials such as chloroquine, which generic drug makers are gearing up to manufacture at scale, and favipiravir, an anti-flu drug from Japan's Fujifilm. Well, the second category is anti-inflammatories that treat the lungs after the immune system is overwhelmed. Regeneron and Sanofi have partnered on Kevzara, which Roche, another pharmaceutical firm, has started a trial on Actemra, approved for use on rheumatoid arthritis in 100 countries. The third group are antibody-based treatments, either from recovered COVID-19 patients or developed in labs, to be given to the seriously ill or as a temporary prophylactic for healthcare workers. Well, Eli Lilly has paired up with Canadian startup ABCELLERA, Abcellera, to work on antibodies developed from one of the first U.S. COVID-19 patients, while Japan's Takeda is developing a new drug derived from the blood plasma of others who have survived the virus. Analysts are eagerly awaiting data from early trials into Gilead's remdesivir, an anti-malarial drug that the California-based biotech developed for Ebola, but has also been shown to work against other coronaviruses in animal studies. Umer Rafat, a biotech analyst at U.S. bank advisory firm Evercore, says that evidence could be published in the next couple of weeks. Now, huge noise. It has been by far the best prospects, Mr. Rafat says. His optimism stems from the drug's ability to disable the machinery that helps the virus replicate, which is similar to that found in Ebola. But the early data may not be spectacular if too many of the patients took it too late in the progression of their disease. Andre Khalil, an investigator in a large remdesivir trial, which plans to recruit 400 patients and is sponsored by the U.S. National Institutes of Health, says they are making patients take the drug within 72 hours of diagnosis. Dr. Khalil ran a clinical trial during the 2014 Ebola outbreak. He believes they moved too slowly to set up a trial then. This is a fight against time. We need to move as fast as possible, he says. We have no idea what works or does not at this point. There are zero therapies specifically against coronavirus. Timing was also important in an early studies published last week of the HIV drug combination, which was dismissed as disappointing, though survival rates were better than patients had taken the antiviral drug earlier in the disease. The anti-malarial chloroquine does have two clear advantages over remdesivir. It is a generic, so it's likely to be far cheaper, and it is a pill. When remdesivir is delivered by an intravenous infusion, so would probably need to be given in hospital. But studies in France and China held by Mr. Trump are small and did not follow the recommended protocols of a randomized controlled trial designed to prevent bias. A study in China released on Tuesday found the drug had no impact. Well, early results from clinical trials in China fueled enthusiasm for a second antiviral, favipiravir, and after reports of faster recovery times for patients that took the drug. Yunyi Okada, president of Fujifilm Toyama Chemical, the unit that produces the branded version Avigan, says that the company is responding to a flood of inquiries from around the world. Our sense of mission became bigger and bigger as it became clear that Avigan may be effective, Mr. Okada had said. We have made the preparations so that we can increase production if needed. Antibody-based treatments could be important for helping the hardest hit and those key workers that need to stay healthy. With New York City now the center of the crisis in the United States, with almost 300 deaths, the wider state is to set up to start testing plasma from recovered patients in a trial with the seriously ill. But most drug makers are looking at refining the process to create a concentrated and purified product or creating artificial antibodies, often developed in mice. And their products may have to go through clinical trials, likely to take many months. Abcellera, was working on a test project on influenza and another coronavirus with the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency when COVID-19 emerged. It rapidly switched to preparing its antibody finding platform for the new virus. After taking blood samples, it was able to generate almost 6 million immune cells from just one patient for antibodies using an artificial intelligence-based platform that can screen down to the individual cell and allows them to find more antibody-secreting cells. Researchers have narrowed it down to the 500 most potent against COVID-19 and partnered with Eli Lilly for the first human trials of the drug by July of this year. Every day between now and the first human testing is mapped out and precious, said Daniel Skolronsky, the chief medical officer of Eli Lilly. Takeda began looking at plasma-derived therapies after they proved effective in reducing mortality during the outbreaks of both severe acute respiratory syndrome, which is SARS, back in 2002 to 2003, and Middle East respiratory syndrome, MERS, in 2009. But the treatment will not be widely available. The plasma will need to be donated by recovered patients. It is not yet known how many people could be treated with the plasma from a single recovered patient. And another obstacle is that all the drugs being tested have potentially serious side effects. Remdesivir may cause liver damage. Avigan can cause birth defects. And Regeneron and Sanofi's Kevzara work by suppressing the immune system, but it could potentially go too far. Rajeev Venkaya, president of Takeda's vaccine business, says the industry is facing a new challenge. It is unprecedented, he says. But what is very different is the opportunity we have with the tools and technologies that can help us to address this in ways that we didn't have in the past. Investment focus. Well, drug makers face similar challenges to vaccine developers. By the time they have the evidence they need, the new virus may have disappeared, but at least it is now clear that COVID-19 is likely to be a longer-term problem. I didn't realize that, but that's evidently the case. Quote, when it becomes a global health crisis, it is easy for companies like us to make decisions to invest. There is a concern for well-being, patients, society, says Dr. Skovronsky. But when it first emerges and there are 5 or 10 patients, it's worth spinning out incredible resources and financial costs when you'll never get repaid if the virus is successfully contained. So even if a drug succeeds, there will be political pressure to price it affordably. Rising Pharmaceuticals, a generic maker of chloroquine, almost doubled the price to $7.66 per 250-milligram pill in the U.S. in January as the coronavirus outbreak raged in China. This month, as the crisis hit the U.S., it cut the price to its previous level. AbbVie, A-B-B-V-I-E, maker of the HIV drug combination, will allow generic makers to manufacture the drug, relinquishing its intellectual property claims in a move that should make it cheaper. Now, drug makers will need to make large investments to increase production fast. Kenneth Kaisen, the director of the Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development, says, quote, you don't want to invest a lot in manufacturing before you know you're going to have a drug on the market, yet you want to make sure you can manufacture as much as needed, perhaps hundreds of thousands of doses. Once a drug is ready to sell, governments are likely to compete to put their citizens first. Already there are reports that the White House tried to buy German vaccine maker CureVac, with Berlin trying to find ways to keep it at home. The UK has banned the parallel export of 3 drugs, Coletra, chloroquine, and hydroxychloroquine, so wholesalers cannot buy drugs intended for UK patients and sell them elsewhere. Now, some believe the pharmaceutical business model simply does not work for pandemics because diseases will always compete for resources with blockbuster drugs that people take for years. Emergent BioSolutions takes a different approach. it specializes in making rescue therapies, quote unquote, for unlikely events, selling the only antidotes to smallpox, anthrax, and botulism to U.S. and allied governments to stockpile in case of bioterrorism. It is now working on an antibody treatment for COVID-19. What differentiates us from just about any other pharma company is that they want an immediate return within 6 to 12 months, and we take a little bit of a longer view, says Robert Kramer, the chief executive of the specialty pharmaceutical company. Despite the obstacles, finding drugs that can be repurposed to help coronavirus patients' recovery is one of the only hopes for their health, their families, and ultimately the economy. Dennis DeBouchier, who leads Evercore's portfolio strategy team, is closely watching when medications might be ready because he believes they are key to getting those people currently in lockdown back outside to spend again. Even as the virus continues to spread, having medications available would take some of the fear out of infection. You may want to go on vacation again. Actually, go to a restaurant, to the movies, he adds. So these are major, major concerns. And let's look at some other things as they're defined. You got antivirals. These are drugs designed for treatment of Ebola, HIV, flu, and malaria. They try to stop the replication of coronavirus by interfering with enzymes that help it copy itself or replicate. They are believed to be most useful in the earlier stages of the disease. The virus uses the same machinery to copy itself as Ebola, giving some experts hope that Gilead's Ebola drug, remdesivir, may stop or may help patients. Then there are anti-inflammatories. These are designed for conditions such as arthritis. Several groups are investigating the potential of IL-6 inhibitors, which lower the production of inflammatory proteins called cytokines, and they are most useful in the latter stages of the disease when some patients suffer from acute respiratory distress syndrome when immune systems become overwhelmed. Then you've got antibodies derived from COVID-19 patients' immune response. They reproduce the antibodies of patients' immune systems to support people with less robust responses. Plasma from recovered patients is being infused into the seriously ill, but drug makers aim to refine the process, strengthening the potency of the antibodies or creating artificial ones that will be more effective. Okay. Well, it's already 11:15, and the mayor hasn't called. So who knows what the story is. Okay, so let's move on. And she knows to call on the other line if she gets on the broadcast. So let me move on and take you to some of the stuff that we've already prepared. Bear with me a moment. One second. Okay. Bear with me. Or actually, while I'm getting that, let me quickly play a commercial for you and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a stenopad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Well, there's a new number at the Yonkers Tribune. If you care to reach out to them, their number is 347-415-4326. That one number is good for the office, for the cell, for the text messaging, and also for leaving a voicemail. So that number is 347-415-4326. So let's just look at some of the stuff that's going on. This is probably the most in your face. Evidently, a 16-year-old girl has become France's youngest coronavirus victim. The mother of France's youngest coronavirus victim has spoken of the unbearable loss of her 16-year-old daughter as the country reported its highest daily toll from the pandemic. Well, French authorities said on Thursday that 365 people had been killed by COVID-19 over the previous 24 hours, taking the national toll of those who have died in hospital to 1,696. The figure does not include those who died from the virus at home or at retirement homes, top French official Jérôme Salomon had told reporters. Now, the teenage girl, her name is Julie A., died in Paris, becoming the youngest French victim of the disease that more often affects or afflicts the elderly or people with underlying health conditions. It's unbearable, the girl's mother, Sabine, told Agence France-Presse from her home in the Parisian suburbs. We were meant to have an ordinary life. A week ago, Julie developed a mild cough, but on Saturday she began to feel short of breath, her mother said. She underwent scans in hospital and several tests for COVID-19, the disease first detected in China late last year, that has now killed more than 23,000 people worldwide. Her condition deteriorated and her death was announced on Thursday, with health officials emphasizing that severe cases are very rare in young people. From the start, we were told that the virus doesn't affect young people. We believed it, like everyone else, Sabine said. Her daughter had no known underlying health problems. Now, France has been in lockdown since March 17 in a bid to show the spread, to slow the spread of the epidemic, and officials have repeatedly warned it will take time for the measures to bear fruit. Salomon said 29,155 people had tested positive for the virus so far nationwide, adding that the real number of cases was likely far higher as testing was reserved for high-risk patients. He said that 3,375 patients were currently in intensive care out of nearly 14,000 people hospitalized after becoming infected. And data showed 42,000 people had been registered by the GP, their general practitioner, as having the coronavirus over the last week alone. Salomon had added again, revealing that testing in France has only revealed a minority of cases. And people in the country are only allowed to step outside for pressing matters such as shopping. It is very difficult to estimate when the peak will come. People who are ill now were infected before the confinement began, explained Salomon. Now there is less contact, people are going out less and get infected less. So we hope there will be fewer people getting sick next week. So that's the story there. Bear with me a moment. I want to go back to a studio screen. Okay. No call there, so we're fine. And I want to go then back to some other issues. 1 second. Where is it? Don't see what I was looking for. Oh, here it is. Evidently, Britain's Johnson has tested positive for the virus as Spain sees record deaths. Seems that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson became the first major world leader to test positive for the coronavirus today, as Spain saw a record number of deaths from the pandemic that is threatening millions around the world. In a grim milestone, the United States overtook China as the country with the most coronavirus cases, while seeing an unprecedented amount of newly unemployed amid fears of a global economic meltdown. and Africa's economic powerhouse, South Africa, on Friday became the latest nation on the continent to start life under lockdown as it reported its first COVID-19 deaths. Now, Johnson, whose country has seen more than 11,600 declared coronavirus cases, 578 deaths, said he had developed mild symptoms over the previous 24 hours and was self-isolating after testing positive. Spain reported that its death toll had hit 4,858 after 769 people died in 24 hours, a record one-day figure for fatalities and far higher than in Italy, which counted 662 in its last daily update on Thursday night. Europe has suffered the brunt of the coronavirus crisis in recent weeks, with millions across the continent on lockdown and the streets of Paris, Rome, and Madrid eerily empty. Prime Minister Edouard Philippe warned that France, reeling from the deaths of more than 1,600 people, including a 16-year-old girl, was facing difficult days ahead. We find ourselves in a crisis. Where are we? In a health situation that will not improve anytime soon. That's what Philippe said. But focus is turning from Europe to the United States, where the number of known infections reached almost 86,000 on Friday, higher than both China and hard-hit Italy. So in New York City, health workers are battling a surging toll of deaths and infected as the U.S. epicenter of the crisis, including an increasing number of younger patients. Now it's 50-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 30-year-olds, said one respiratory therapist at the Jewish Medical Center in Queens, New York. They didn't listen about not going out or protecting themselves and washing their hands, he said. To watch somebody in their 30s die, it's hard. You can't have visitors. They're in the room by themselves on a ventilator. It's very depressing. U.S. President Donald Trump, who has been accused of downplaying the enormous scale of the crisis, spoke by telephone with China's Xi Jinping, who said the two countries needed to unite to fight the pandemic. China has been through much and has developed a strong understanding of the virus. We are working closely together. Much respect, Trump tweeted after the call. The warm words were in contrast to weeks of finger-pointing between the two countries, especially the White House's repeated references to the Chinese virus. Now, the coronavirus first emerged in China late last year before spreading globally, with 539,360 declared cases registered in 183 countries and territories. Beijing managed to contain its spread with lockdowns and quarantines, and its epicenter, Wuhan, is in the process of easing severe movement restrictions in place for 2 months. Now, China was also readying to bar entry to foreigners out of concern over a surge of imported cases, highlighting the difficulty of containing a virus in a globalized world. 3 billion people around the world have been told to stay indoors as healthcare systems, even in the most developed countries, are stretched to a breaking point. 3 billion people around the world have been told to stay indoors as healthcare systems, even in the most developed nations, are stretched to breaking point. Well, medical workers have been having to stay abroad or to make difficult the choices. If I've got three patients in only one bed, I have to choose who gets it, said Sarah Chinchilla, a pedestrian at a hospital near Madrid. People are dying. Who could be saved, but there's no space in intensive care? So even with lockdown implemented around the world, researchers at Imperial College London said Thursday the global death toll could be mad. Just staggering. Their models show 1.86 million people could die, with nearly 470 million, surviving. So we got that problem. And even with lockdowns implemented around the world, researchers at the Imperial College of London said the global death toll could be staggering. Their model shows 1.86 million people could die, with nearly 470 million people infected this year. A failure to act swiftly by imposing lockdowns and strict social distancing could make those numbers far higher, they warned. And the lockdowns and other measures are wreaking havoc on the global economy, with fears of a downturn worse than the Great Depression of the 1930s. The leaders from a group of 20 major economies held crisis talks by video link on Thursday, announcing a $5 trillion financial rescue package to counteract the social, economic, and financial impacts of the coronavirus and or the pandemic. So very, very compelling sort of news, and just that, very, very compelling indeed. Let me just quickly look again. All right. We're not getting a call from the mayor. So I'll look at one more time. And where are we here? All right. I'll just check to see what else we've got going here that might be of value. Oh, yeah. There have been no reports, unfortunately, from Yonkers with regard to the tolls that we have here. So let me just see if I could find this for you. One second. All right. Okay, I think this is it. This was yesterday's report. Here was yesterday's report. The most recent numbers that were spoken about were the numbers of new fatalities, and this was expressed by none other than George Latimer. And so let me just quickly look here and see where this is. Bear with me a moment. One second. I may have made a mistake here. All right. All right. No, for some reason I made a mistake. So, anyway, it's 11:30. Might as well wish you all a wonderful weekend. Stay safe the best you can. And if you can, stay sequestered rather than going out and about. And but you never know. Some people still want to go. I know the ice skating rink at the bridge. I forgot now. It's the Murray Skating Rink. I don't know if that's still open or maybe closed. So you might want to call them up in case there's a game going on Saturday. So we'll see where all that leads. Okay, I think that we've had it. There's no more time for us today. And we'll just wish you a goodbye. And, all right, let me just see where this is. I'm just in shock. Can't seem to find this. All right. Okay, oh, here it is. It's hiding on behind another tab. All right, so we're going to speak to you on Monday. That'll be our next outing with you. And let me just quickly look. That's going to be the 2nd of, no, sorry. That'll be the 6th of April. Is that right? No, I'm sorry. Well, the next time we're going to be together will be on the 30th. So we're going to speak to John Bailey, Michael Edelman, and Jose Alvarado. the county board legislator, and then there'll be me. So that's the story. So John Bailey at 10, Michael Edelman at 10:30, Hedgy Harris at 10:30, or that's actually 11, and 11 o'clock is going to be his rally, his, I don't know. So anyway, that's the story with us. We'll wish you a goodbye and a healthy weekend. Stay safe. Check in on your friends. Do it telepathically. Or if you don't have the telepathic capacity, then do it through the internet. Reach out by email, reach out by text, and so on and so forth. So all the best. Take care and goodbye.